Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. We've been talking this week about the fate of the middle class. Let's continue the conversation and bring some other voices into it. John Berlow has been on our show many times. His official title is Director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. CEI.org is their website. And John is, John, I'm so glad you could join me live in the studio here in New York.
Thanks. It's good to be with you in the Big Apple, Tom.
Yeah, it's great to have you. It's a hoot. So the Center for Entrepreneurship, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, my take, let's start with the biggest picture possible. Why do we have an economy? Do we have an economy? Do we the people, through the instrument of democratic government, small d democratic government or republic or whatever you want to call it, do we the people give all kinds of benefits to people like me who run a small business or people like, General Electric, who runs a big business, tax advantages, tax incentives, all kinds? Do we do that because business will somehow cause benefit to inure to the citizens of this country? Or is the purpose of the citizens of the country to serve the interests of business?
I think, Tom, it's sort of like the First Amendment. It's economic liberty, whereas, you know, it's the liberty of the individual to build his own livelihood, to create a product that people will like. At the same time, the utility of the product, provided it's not done by force or fraud, I mean, benefits the citizenry that, you know, Bill Gates with Microsoft, Larry Page and Sergey Brin with Google, they themselves got rich but they benefited a whole lot of other people who use Google and Microsoft.
But there's no free market about Microsoft. I mean, Bill Gates made his money because of copyright laws, because laws that say that, you know, he actually bought something and improved it and developed it, but nobody else can copy it. It's very different than, for example, Linux. I mean, you know, he made his money because of government intervention in the marketplace, period.
Well, property rights are important both, I think, in land rights and in intellectual property rights, as far as, you know, if you or someone else writes a book. I mean, I'm not, you know, I think they're cracking down on downloaders and things like that too much, so the intellectual property rights are somewhat different. But, I mean, yeah, the rule of law and contract and property rights, and as long as it's, you know, you make a consensual choice. And I think what the Center for Entrepreneurship is concerned about is making sure that the next Bill Gates or Meg Whitman of eBay, you know, that they don't face, you know, barriers to building the next Microsoft or eBay that could, you know, could revolutionize an industry and benefit so many people.
But the bottom line here is that there is a substrate of rules. There is a substrate of the commons that made it possible for Bill Gates to be successful, that made it possible for me to successfully build businesses, that makes it possible for the Competitive Enterprise Institute to exist, that we have a public education system, that we have public roads, that we have a socialist public education system. We have socialist roads. We have socialist fire departments. We have socialist police departments. How can you come along and say, you know, the way to solve the problems, the economic problems of this country, is to deregulate our way out of it, when all of history shows that a completely deregulated economy produces what Charles Dickens chronicled in A Christmas Carol? It produces a huge class of the working poor, a very small middle class, the mercantilists, and a very small group of very wealthy people. That's what a normal economy is.
Well, you need the government to enforce the rule of law to prevent force and fraud. I would agree with that. I mean, I would actually disagree with some of the things that you had said that I would agree are socialized. Like, I'm for school vouchers and, you know, having more freedom of choice there. But I.
So you want the government to pay for people to go to school?
I think
that's socialism.
I think vouchers are, I want more, I'm for more individual control with vouchers. And,
so should the government, if the government's going to pay for people to go to elementary school and junior high school and high school, should the government pay for people to go to college?
That's an, certainly getting rid of the barriers for people to go to college, as far as, you know, the things like 529 savings accounts. And, I mean, we can debate what the ideal libertarian society or ideal socialist society would be.
No, but the concept, here's the concept, John. As a society, as a culture, and I realize, you know, most libertarians and certainly objectivists discard the notion of a social contract, but I would say it's very real. And as a society, we have collectively decided that if we invest $5,000 a year, the average cost, maybe $6,000 a year of educating a child. So over 10 years of education, if we invest $60,000 in a kid, that educated person is going to produce at least 10 times that in tax revenue during the course of their life. But why not simply extend that to college as well, as virtually every other country in the world has done? You know, Ronald Reagan shut it down in California, but it was working very well. It was creating enormous wealth by investing in people. And if you accept that, and it seems like you are, because if you're in favor of school vouchers, you're in favor of the government investing in kids, right? Do I have that right?
Yeah, I'm in favor of school vouchers as far as being better than what exists now.
Okay, so you yes. so if you're in favor of investing in our young people in public education, then what's wrong with and you're in favor of investing in generally in infrastructure, schools, police, fire departments, things like that?
Police and fire departments. As I said, I don't know. I mean, we could have vouchers. But yeah, police and fire departments certainly.
So how do we make sure? Actually, the larger question is: it even important to make sure that there's a middle class in the United States? That you know, going back to Teddy Roosevelt's notion that if you work a 40-hour, it was a 50-hour week in 1908 when he was talking about if you work a 50-hour week. And you are a good citizen, that you make enough, that you are absolutely guaranteed that you will make enough that you can put your kids through school, that you can cover your health care costs, that you'll have enough money to retire when you get old, that by the end of your working career you will have paid off your home, that you can take a vacation a couple weeks a year. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt called this the living wage. He was the guy who invented that phrase and said it's the job of government to make sure there's a living wage. Without government intervention in the marketplace, that will not exist.
Tom, I'm not for cradle to grave security. And one of the things, there's a saying, if the government could give you everything, it could take everything you have. If you want to work for less than the minimum wage.
John, I mean,
no, if you want to work for less than the minimum wage, if you're an entrepreneur starting out and you can't pay what the government defines as a living wage, I mean, most freedoms. There's a debate about what the government should do, whether, you know, positive for the citizens. But the true rights, I think, can only be negative. Freedom of speech doesn't mean someone buys you a newspaper. The Second Amendment doesn't mean that you subsidize the NRA's gun purchases.
I agree with you. The Constitution is a list of negative rights. At least the Bill of Rights is. It is the things the government can't do. I'm in agreement with you on that. But Franklin Roosevelt in 1936, when he accepted the nomination for his second term, said, an old judge once said, a necessitous man is not a free man. How can you claim that somebody who knows that they are one paycheck away from being homeless, that they are one illness away from being bankrupt for the rest of their lives and never even being able to care for their own children, can consider themselves free in the United States of America?
They could consider themselves themselves free with the mutual network of support, the little platoons that Edmund Burke called it, and also I'm talking about, you know, voluntary action in communities, also things like lifting some of the barriers, like health savings accounts, you know, having it be portable, your medical savings, you know, giving the individual the same.
So you're suggesting if I've got $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, $30,000, that would be 6 years worth of a health savings account in the bank, and I get an illness that's going to cost $1 million, which is, you know, the average cost, I guess, these days of cancer, that I should consider myself a free person?
It's a very difficult situation. Freedom doesn't always mean, you know, that it's perfect. But
you're suggesting that freedom means the freedom to just die a miserable death because nobody's going
to
help you.
You know, we want to encourage people to, you know, to save and thrift and also that, you know, the local governments are usually the closest. I mean, someone else, you know, it's always the same as the story of the ant and the grasshopper that, you know, when you say, you know, the government's going to be there no matter what, do you punish those who are thrifty, those who are saved, those, you know,
so you're in favor of the of the ant side of that story, right?
Yes.
The ant is a collective social animal. And yet libertarians are promoting anti-collective, you know, the noble individual story, the grasshopper story.
Well, the ant, they're reporting the ant story on a voluntary level.
Okay. Let's continue the conversation right after this break. John Burlaw is with us. He is the director of the Center for Entrepreneurship with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, live in the studio with us here in New York at the headquarters of Air America Radio. Today we're talking about deregulation. Actually, we haven't even gotten to deregulation. Let's dig into that, and then we'll pick up some phone calls here at 866-303-2270. Tom Hartman with you. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 21 minutes past the hour. Our program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Teamster.org is the website. John Burlaw, my regular debating partner, sparring partner.
Friendly sparring partner.
There you go. There you go.
And a couple issues we've even agreed on.
Yeah, there you go. A good guy. John Burlaw, the director of the Center for Entrepreneurship with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org is the website, has been kind enough to drop by our studios here in Manhattan today and have this conversation with us. And, John, let's get into deregulation for a few minutes, and then we'll pick up some calls from our listeners if you'd like, and we can kick some of these topics around if people have calls specific to the issue of deregulation and the nature of the economy. Your argument, if I have this right, is that – well, actually, let me just let you give your argument. How do we solve the economic crisis the country's facing right now?
Well, one way we don't solve it is to just, you know, it's like some of the things they're proposing now is like to say, shut off the internet if you get a computer virus. Now that the campaign is over, and I wasn't crazy about John McCain, the things that John McCain, the deregulation he was blamed for supporting, were actually things that Bill Clinton signed and were in part, even Clinton officials admitted, in part responsible for the 90s prosperity, the interstate lifting the restrictions on interstate branching of banks.
That was not prosperity. That was a bubble. I would submit to you, I am not a fan of Bill Clinton, broadly speaking. I mean, I think he did some good things as president, but his economic policies, in my opinion, were a disaster by and large. And the deregulation and the tax cutting that Clinton did later in his administration led directly to not prosperity, but to a bubble. It was called the dot-com bubble. Remember?
But we had some permanent gains from that growth, and then that bubble. We have, you know, the web streaming over the internet, like we have the people having computers.
Yeah, but why have to go through a bubble? I mean, every time we've cut taxes, in the 1920s. You know, the top marginal tax rate in 1920 was almost 80%. We cut it down to 25%. Boom, we got a bubble followed by a crash in 29.
That was when Hoover raised taxes from 25% to 63%, and then FDR raised those on top of that. That was one of the factors in the Depression last year.
I'm sorry, that all happened after the crash.
But the crash didn't necessarily lead to the Depression. That's what authors such as Amity Schlaes and others have concluded.
So you're suggesting then that after the crash in 29, in 30, late 32, when Hoover slightly raised taxes and raised tariffs, and 33, 34, 35, when Roosevelt dramatically raised taxes, that was a bad thing for the United States. If that's the case, why is it that the 30 years following that, when the top marginal tax rate on people making more than $3.2 million was 91%, we had the biggest period of sustained prosperity in the history of the United States? Reagan comes into office, he drops taxes in 82, And immediately we have a bank crisis, the largest bank crisis since 1929, and another, a bubble, and then a boom, and then a crash. And then he drops taxes again in 87, and within 6 months we have another bubble, and then a crash. No, I didn't mean, boom, I meant crash. And a second bank crisis in 87. Remember Black Monday? And then Clinton comes into power. He raises taxes. We go back to sustained growth. Then he starts deregulating and cutting taxes toward the end of his tenure. And boom, you've got another bubble and another crash. George W. comes in. He cuts taxes. We get another bubble and a crash. I defy you to find a time in American history when raising taxes has not produced sustained prosperity and lowering taxes has not produced a bubble and a crash. Name one.
I would say the 80s through 2000, and I would just say that, you know, because I think we did have sustained prosperity with a few, I mean, substantial hiccups. The SNL crisis, I mean, that didn't affect really the standard of living that much. I don't think it was due to tax cuts, more to raising deposit insurance and the banks, you know, had that moral hazard and other thing. But, you know, a stagnant economy, Tom, is a stable economy. You have prosperity. There's the risk of the bubble. You can look at, you know, we were talking before about a living wages going down. That doesn't matter as much if, as a result, prices skyrocket, beer is $50. An economist from the Fed, the Federal Reserve, named Michael Cox, wrote about how hours per work, when you look at that, you work less hours these days for a TV, for computers, just look at the price of a long-distance phone call. All of that has to be factored into the standard of living as well as wages. And, you know, there's more plus.
Do.
Plus individual freedom to start your own business. The fact that, you know, Bill Gates could start a Microsoft, Meg Whitman could turn eBay around. All of this, you know, having the opportunity society, even if you want to have, you know, talk about, you know, healthcare and education, you know, having, you know, the ability to, you know, start your own business, things like that, is part of the quality of life.
But you're arguing for deregulation, and isn't the point of regulation to prevent predators from screwing up the system that you and I both appreciate?
That's when it's justified, but all too frequently it protects existing business and acts as a barrier to entry as a small businesses. I mean, right now there are banks, I was just reading Washington Business Journal, there are some banks like from North Carolina, other states, that are actually expanding into D.C. that weren't stupid, weren't greedy as far as the subprime mortgages. And the thing is, if you would reimpose Glass-Steagall,
which is a regulation.
From
Roosevelt.
And I'm against it, but you would hurt the new entrants by opposing regulation, not the established guys.
So you're opposed to Glass-Steagall?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. I thought you were saying we should reimpose it, which would be my position. John Berlow is with us. He is the director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We'll take your calls at 866-303-2270 right after this. 27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call
6-6-303-2270. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, there's just downright crazy stuff going on out there in the world. Just totally, totally crazy. Yeah, maybe this guy is. Jonas Jacob. He stole $300,000, 300,000 pounds, British pounds, actually, worth of cigarettes, and was trying to make a getaway from the police. Thought he could outrun the cops on the Romanian border. Only problem? He was driving a cart pulled by a donkey. Didn't make it very far. And in other strange news, in Italy, this is downright strange. Murdoch and Berlusconi. No, that's not it. Where did it go? I've lost it. Anyhow, in Italy, they're paying people. I can do this from memory. They are paying people to name their children after Benito Mussolini. This is not official government policy, but there's a group that says, hey, we're going to have kids. We're going to, if you name him Benito or Rachel, his wife, we'll pay you. Downright nuts. John Berlow is with us. He is the director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. CEI.org is the website. And John and I are going to take your calls. And let's start out with Kevin in Warrington, Missouri. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind?
Hi, Kevin.
Good morning, Tom. I would just like to challenge your guest there about regulations and the need for them. They're absolutely necessary. When was the last time that you heard anyone refer to hardening cockpit doors?
There's a point for you, John. For example, back in the 70s, when there was all those hijackings to Cuba, the legislators proposed hardening cockpit doors. Israel had done it, and it worked quite well for them. And the airline industry said, what? That's going to cost us $100,000 per airplane, and you're interfering with commerce. We're not going to do that. And had they done that, 9/11 wouldn't have happened. I mean, isn't there a place for regulation?
Well, we've never completely deregulated. I mean, I'm just defending primarily the deregulation that's existed as far as, like, letting, commercial and banks sell insurance, interstate branching of banks. And so we've never had complete deregulation. Having said that, I mean, I can imagine if there weren't an FAA and airlines actually were to compete on safety or their safety records more, we might get some safety innovation.
But they have 30 years to do it.
Well, we have this illusion, the FAA, presents that, all airlines are equally safe, and that sort of takes away from the disincentive to the consumer to research and to ask airlines about their policies, for airlines to advertise.
Come on, John, shouldn't we, as citizens of the United States, none of us are polymaths. I mean, none of us are absolutely conversant in everything. Shouldn't we, as a people, say collectively, I'm perfectly willing to do my homework when it comes to who's got the cheapest fare, or who's got the best route, or who's got the on-time takeoff, or who's going to leave when I need to leave. But I shouldn't have to go out and inspect the cowling around the engine to make sure that it's bolted on right. And I shouldn't have to make sure that the they've changed the oil on the jet, or whatever they do on jet engines. I'm just an old prop plane pilot myself. At a certain point, this whole idea of buyer beware, when society is so large and products are, from drugs to airlines, are so complex, the idea of deregulating seems to me like an invitation to corporate parasitism or ripoff. I mean, it's predatorship. I think I'm inventing words here.
Well, I mean, airlines, wouldn't stay in business if one airline, fell out of the sky after another. It's still the safest form of travel. But I think too often, where you have a floor as far as safety goes, can also be a ceiling where they say, as long as we're complying with the government rules, we don't need to do anything extra. And, the government agencies sort of promote the illusion that everybody's the same as far as safety. It's a disincentive. I mean, you can't know everything about an airline, but certainly the safety record, I would say, is as important as how cheap the tickets are. It's your life.
I will give you, there are some industries that actually lobby for regulations so that they can have a floor or ceiling. I guess you flip the metaphor either way. For example, the GMO industry. They wanted regulations, genetically modified organisms. They wanted regulations that made it illegal to label products whether or not they were genetically modified. They wanted regulations that made it legal for them to exist because it brought them into being.
And frequently, I'd say,
and I'm not a fan of those regulations.
Right. liability would be, I mean, you could still, you know, sue an airline or something like that. I mean, you know, the lawsuits should be reasonable, but I mean, that could, you know, rather than having a one size fits all regulation.
But then you get the guys who run around about tort reform and a life is only worth $250,000. Jason in Valdosta, Georgia, is on the line with us. Hey, Jason.
Hi, Jason.
Welcome to the conversation.
Hi. Hi, how you doing? You were talking about healthcare earlier, and I've got a question for your guest. It's actually kind of this is a very, very personal thing, to me, the whole healthcare issue, and here's why. Whenever I was 11 years old, my mom started going for a teaching degree. While she was doing that, she was subbing. She did not have a full-time job. She did not have healthcare through her employer, obviously. Whenever I was 14 years old, she was diagnosed with cancer. She was misdiagnosed because of our wonderful medical system that the opponents of universal health care keep on touting as the greatest in the world. Not only did she not have the money to actually get proper health care, but if she had universal health care, she would be alive today. What it sounds like is your guest is saying that my mother deserved to die because she did not have the means to take care of herself. She was diverting the money and stuff that she could have been using to help herself to me and my sister to give us a better life, and because of that she was not in a position to help herself.
John,
Jason, I'm so sorry that happened, and that's really not what I'm saying at all. I think the core of the problem with this and so many other tragic cases is the fact that, you know, your health care is tied to your employer. And the employer tax deduction, which was an advent of World War II, where they gave tax exemptions your salary was capped, but they gave tax exemptions for wages. They kept that. What I'm saying is, you know, starting with, you know, with health savings account, allow individuals as well as employers to be able to use pre-tax income. Your employer can contribute that. That was part of the.
But how could any of that hit the $250,000 to $1 million cost of getting cancer, John?
It can't.
Was when she was a substitute teacher that she was the job.
The
health insurance was
dependent on
the job.
And that's a common thing. In fact, that's something you were celebrating a minute ago.
You know, if you get a high deductible health plans, Phil Graham, the much vilified Phil Graham, said, if I were to get, you know, have grocery insurance today, health insurance, you know, I would be getting, you know, T-bone steak and so would my dog. You insurance should be for things like cancer that are really high cost things. And we should encourage, you know, out of pocket, you know, with the tax deduction for routine care, you know, coming from individuals so they will shop around.
So are you suggesting are you saying that health care is not a right but a privilege with the exception of serious illnesses?
I'm saying that I don't believe in positive rights. But there are a lot of barriers to getting and keeping, you know, health insurance and, you know, a high deductible policy, you know, that individuals. I mean, if you do universal health care, there are some ways are better than others.
And, Jefferson and Franklin and Adams, I mean, Jefferson wrote it, but the other two and John Jay edited it, and everybody, you know, 56 people signed it in the Declaration of Independence that we have the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, liberty, we can agree or disagree on the meaning of that, but I think that the word life is, you know, pretty hard to dispute. It means being alive. How can you have the right to life when the ability to heal yourself is beyond your economic means?
The medical advances, the competition. I mean, we have, I mean, through the free market system, I mean, medicines and things like that, they only could have dreamed of at Jefferson and Hamilton's time.
But they're not available to people like Jason's mother.
They might very well be. I mean, I would, for anyone in this situation today, I mean, check to see some of the free programs that the pharmaceutical companies provide.
So we should just beg the rich people for their largesse. Please help me.
I would say, there are things, you know, mutual aid societies. That's some of the things that were evolving before the welfare state. And I would say things like, you know, like health savings accounts, moving in the direction where your health insurance isn't dependent on your employer, where the individual has the same tax, the same tax deduction. I mean, we cover the poor through Medicaid now. But just make it so it's not dependent on your job. And
John Berlow is with us. He's the director of the Center for Entrepreneurship and a great spokesman for the, I would say, libertarian point of view.
Yes.
I refer to libertarians as Republicans who want to get laid and smoked dope. I hope I don't offend you that way. We can discuss that after the break. CEI.org is the website. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. John Berlow in the studio with us from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the director of the Center for Entrepreneurship there. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, toll-free nationwide and internationally in Brooklyn, New York. Dion, you're on the air. Hey, Dion.
Hey, good afternoon. How you guys doing?
Just great. What's up?
I got a question for a guest. Could he give me a specific regulation and explain to me how specifically does it keep the little guy or the startup guy out of the game? And would you then be able to respond and give him a solution, and maybe, you know, the two factions could work hand in hand? Because it doesn't seem to me like they're against regulation. They just want to make sure that the startup guy and the entrepreneurs can play the game with the big boys.
Yeah, well, I'm all in favor of that, too. So let's get right to where the rubber meets the road here, John.
Dion, since we're all in New York, Brooklyn and Manhattan, I would say the New York taxi monopolies, where you have to have medallions, and sometimes I believe it's upwards of $50,000, somebody starting out in the taxi industry has to for a new taxi driver to get a medallion, where they frequently have to take out these loans to get them. And whereas you could have something, you know, a simple system, you know, where you could have some regulation where anyone who passes a traffic safety record and, you know, meets some various tests could become a taxi driver without having to, you know, having this limit to the number of them.
Do you know, John, I've taken taxis everywhere from, you know, Cairo to London to Bombay to Perth actually, in a lot of third world countries as well, where they're probably not so well regulated, and have had some pretty damn scary rides in parts of East Africa. Do you know any place in the world where it works, that taxis are completely unregulated? I mean, I've been in countries where you're warned. In fact, I was just in one a few months ago where I was warned not to flag down a taxi on the street, instead to have the hotel call a car for you, because they will just take you into an alley and stick you up.
Well, I know some places that don't have, and I would be in favor of simply streamlining this, where it doesn't cost $50,000 to get a medallion, or there's not a quota. I mean, I would say D.C. has pretty free entry compared to New York. I mean, there are meters, and yes.
So you're still in favor of regulation here. Just in favor of a more rational regulation.
I'm in favor of more rational than less rational. I would see how far it goes, but, you know, get rid of the worst excesses. I mean, one other I would bring up for a little further up the scale is small entrepreneurs with Sarbanes-Oxley. How, you know, even, you know, Tom Daschle and Nancy Pelosi have said it's hurting this, having unintended effects on small public companies.
I could be wrong on this, but I thought Sarbanes-Oxley didn't kick in unless you were either a publicly traded company or you had more than 200 employees.
You were a publicly traded company, but at one time, you know, Home Depot became a publicly traded company after four stores. It used to be a lot easier to be a publicly traded company, and you didn't have to rely as much on the debt market. The co-founder of Home Depot, Bernie Marcus, has said that he could not have done gone public when Home Depot did and raised the money, had Sarbanes-Oxley and some of the other rules been in effect.
Then isn't there which raises a really important point. Isn't there a point in time where you say, you know, if the only way you can do business is to not pay a living wage, if the only way you can do business is to not operate transparently so that we, the people, know that you're not harming us, if the only way you can do business is to sell toxic products, then you have no damn right to do business in this country.
Well, I would say, you go to CEI.org. I mean, Sarbanes-Oxley goes far beyond, you know, ensuring transparency. It has accountants chasing after things like, you know, who, what employee passwords are, how many letters you have, who has the office keys, you know, a bunch of trivial things. That's sort of the problem with it. But as far as the wage goes, I mean, if prices go up for everyone because of labor costs, that hits the middle class too. So that's, you know, I mean, as far as, you know, harm and toxic chemicals, then we agree they're toxic.
Speaking of taxis, Kitty in Queens, New York wants to get in on the conversation.
Hi, Kitty.
Hey, Kitty.
Hi. Listen, I don't know about you, but I don't want to go riding around in anybody's taxi that hasn't been inspected and the driver hasn't been tested to know if he knows the rules of the road and where things are.
Yeah,
that's
in
what
London,
we do,
you know,
here in New York City.
In London, the taxi drivers have to take this incredible test. I mean, it takes a year to study for this thing. They have to know every, you know, all the, it's just mind-boggling, and they've
well, here they
the
only
best
have to study 24 hours.
Yeah, yeah,
right. I mean, I haven't had, you know, I hate to put down to your seat, I haven't had the best taxi drivers here under this regulated system. I've had some good ones. I have had some ones that were less than good. But what is paying, you know, $50,000 for a medallion have to do with, you know?
Well, that's that middle ground. And Kitty,
I mean,
thank you for pointing that out.
We should all be for rational regulation.
Yeah, no, I mean, my best friend, Jerry Snyderman, who I'm staying with, and I usually do when I come into town, and Jerry and I have been partners in two businesses back in the early 70s, was a taxi driver in this town. And I can tell you from, you know, being kind of close to it, that there's kind of a taxi mafia, as it were, among not among the people who are driving the cars, but among the folks who own some of them. But that's and in part, it's because of what you're talking about, John. So, I think that there's some area where we can perhaps agree on some of these things. But Gene in San Francisco wants to get in on this. Hey, Gene, welcome to the show.
Hi, Gene.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. We seem to lack a clear term, a definite word or words for what the absence of business and employment regulations means. Yet clearly, the absence of regulation is the granting of a freedom to institute varieties of slavery on the majority by the few. Economic slavery, contractual slavery, predation. How can we even talk about this? I don't think we teach people in this country even a comparison between pure capitalism and socialism and Marxism.
Well, we have only about 30 seconds left. John, I mean, Stephanie.
Voluntary agreements are not slavery.
But Gene's point is that if you're in an economy where the only jobs available to you are Bob Cratchit jobs, you know, basically slavery jobs, then it is slavery.
Well, you want to have less regulation so that a variety of entrepreneurs can grow, and that benefits, that gives employees more options too, especially with things like stock options.
What does stock options have to do with people starting businesses?
Well, stock options, well, it makes workers entrepreneurs, that they could go to, you know, Microsoft or
no, it makes workers gamblers.
Well, sweat equity is the word.
You know, yeah, I know all about sweat equity. I'll tell you, having started a number of businesses. John Berlow, interesting conversation. You can read more about his point of view over at the Center for Entrepreneurship at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. And for the record, you disagree with my characterization of libertarians, so we'll have to pick that one up next time.
If that's do what you live and let live.
Yeah, there you go. John, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Stephen Moore on the line with us, an economist and policy analyst who founded and served as president of the Club for Growth from 1999 to 2004. Member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, senior economics writer at the journal, opinionjournal.com also, a place where you can find his writing. Stephen Moore, is opinionjournal.com best place for you?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Stephen. Great to have you with us. You have been writing, you wrote this piece, The End of Prosperity, How Higher Taxes Will Doom the Economy If We Let It Happen. Here's what baffles me. If you look back from 1913, when we first instituted the income tax in the United States, until today, if you look at those periods of time when income taxes on the rich were the highest, those were the times when our economy was strong, stable, and had the strongest year-to-year growth, both in GDP and in real wages for the middle class. If you look at those times when tax cuts happened, Those were the times when we had bubbles followed by busts. How is it possible, given the reality of this, you know, this last roughly 100 years of our experience with the income tax, that you can make the assertion that cutting taxes is good or that raising taxes is bad?
Well, Tom, I guess you and I are reading the history books a little differently. I mean, if you look at the fastest growth decades for America in the last 100 years, they were the 20s, the 60s, and the 80s. And those were all decades when we did really dramatic supply-side tax rate reductions. I mean, that happened under Coolidge, it happened under Jack Kennedy in the 60s, and then it happened under Reagan.
Well, you just made my point, Stephen. First of all, it didn't happen under Jack Kennedy. It happened under LBJ, and it wasn't huge. It was from 91% down to 70%, and they closed so many loopholes, as Kennedy said, that it was functionally a tax increase. But you just made my point. In the 20s, we took the top marginal tax rate in 1920 from around 85-90% down to around 25%. It produced a period of boom of about 8 or 9 years, and then a crash. And then George W. Bush did the same thing. It produced a crash. Ronald Reagan did the same thing. It produced a crash.
Hey, wait, what crash are you talking about that Ronald Reagan caused?
Well, how about Black Monday in 1987, right after his second, his big tax cut?
I remember that very vividly. I was working for Reagan at the time. Within 9 months, the stock market had regained everything it lost. So if you look over the period from, 81 to 88, we had a huge stock market boom.
We had more banks fail, Stephen, during that period of time than at any time since 1933.
Yeah, but the economy over that period was hugely positive, and just as it was in the 90s. I mean, the most important thing we've done over the last 30 years is we cut the top income tax rate from 70% to 35%, and it caused America to have the biggest job boom and wealth boom in the history of civilization. So I think it's pretty much a validation.
So you're going to ignore the period from 1940 to 1980, roughly, when we actually had strong and steady growth. We didn't have bubbles. We didn't have busts.
Wait, Tom. The 1970s was the worst decade for American incomes in history. Don't you remember we had 14.5% inflation rates and we had, a total deindustrialization that went on in the 1970s. That's why Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford lost their elections.
Well, wages were going up as well. I agree we had a real problem with inflation, and I think that we probably will agree that we can track that back to running the Vietnam War on debt and LBJ trying to have his great society on debt, and the bill came due. But that's got nothing to do with tax policy. The fact of the matter is that when we had...
Because what happened in the 70s, Tom, I mean, this is actually a good history lesson for people. You had a 70% top tax rate. You had a very highly graduated tax systems. And because we had the twin killer of inflation at that time, what happened in the 70s was you had everybody's their incomes were going up, but their real purchasing power wasn't because of 14% inflation rates. And yet they were getting kicked higher and higher into higher income tax brackets. And that's one of the reasons you have the economy collapse as it did in 1970, 80, and 81.
No, I would submit to you that the collapse of the economy in the 80s was the consequence of Reagan cutting taxes. In the 70s, you had a top marginal tax rate of 90%. I was doing business in the 70s, Stephen, and I'll tell you, let's just talk about the logic of this. I remember owning a company and knowing that if I paid my, I 22 years old, I was making more than my father had ever made in his life. I thank God I was very successful. And I remember owning a company with 18 employees in Lansing, Michigan, and knowing that if I paid myself any more money beyond what I'd paid myself for that year, more than half of it was going to the government. So what I did with that money was I invested in equipment for my company and I hired 2 new people. Now, had taxes been lowered, I would have simply put that money in my pocket and stashed it in a Swiss bank account. Tell me how it is that having high taxes on rich people doesn't benefit the economy, just like in that example that I just gave you.
All right. Well, here's the thing. I'm in favor of what you're talking about. When people reinvest their money in a company, I agree with you. They shouldn't have to pay.
But the only reason they do that is because if they don't, they're going to pay taxes on it.
No, you don't understand. If you have a
I was there.
No, I'm talking about the whole. I can't talk about your individual circumstance. What I'm saying is that if you have a very high tax rate of 50% or 60% or 70%, the incentive for someone to go out and actually reinvest that money is very low because you only get to keep 30 cents on the dollar.
No, no, the incentive to keep the money in the company. The company is the prime vehicle of wealth, of creating
right.
wealth. The incentive to keep the money in the company rather than pull it out as a paycheck and then invest it in stock or something like that, which I would argue is speculation rather than investment by and large, is very high. When you have high tax rates, what that does is it causes wealthy people to say, you know, I think I'll keep the money in the business. And so you don't have businesses being bought and sold. You don't have the mergers and acquisition mania of the 80s that came along with the Reagan tax cuts that wiped out small businesses. You know, you and I are both old enough to remember that in the 70s and the early 80s all across America, you could walk into any city in America and know where you were because every business or most businesses were locally owned and they all looked different. Now, they all look the same. You could drop out of an airplane at 100,000 feet, and wherever you ended up in America, you look around and there's a Holiday Inn and an olive tree or Olive Garden.
Well, Tom, you're scaring me because I do think a lot of liberals look back at the 1970s as some kind of golden age.
I'm talking about the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s.
If you just look, Tom, at what happened to family incomes over the period, you know, like 1977 to 1981, that was the worst four-year period for family incomes since the Great Depression. And the reason was because inflation was so high, people, and they were losing so many jobs, that people's incomes went way, way down. They couldn't afford to buy anything.
Right, exactly. We got nailed, and there was no change in tax policy that led to that. None whatsoever. That was the consequence of fighting the Vietnam War on credit. And we're going to see the same thing, by the way, when the bill comes due for the Iraq War, which George W. Bush has fought on credit.
You and I agree on that. I mean, the cost of all this borrowing that we're doing right now is so
is nuts. It's absolutely nuts. Yeah, but my point is that had nothing to do with tax policy.
Tom, can we both agree that it is complete insanity to talk about a $500 billion spending program next year? I mean, that is how could
depends on how you spend
right
it.
Mind,
there's
anybody in the right mind think that we got to spend more government money?
Stephen Moore, if we're talking with Stephen Moore, a variety of websites, but it's not on my that you prefer is opinionjournal.com. I would submit to you that a $500 billion spending program would be a mistake. On the other hand, a $500 billion investment program would be very wise. If we put $500 billion into free college education for our kids, into hospitals and schools and public infrastructure, we're going to make 50 times that over the next 30, 40 years.
You mean to have the government spend the money?
That's right. It's an I'm not talking about spending. I'm talking about investing.
How in the world is government spending the money an investment?
There's a difference. If you buy a bomb and you drop it on another country, there's no subsequent value from that. That's spending. If you build school and you educate people, they then contribute to the tax base. That's an investment.
If dropping a bomb keeps us safe from terrorism, then I think it has a high value on the economy.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but I don't feel personally that either Vietnam or Iraq, you know, kept us particularly safe. But
you know, you say that we should have more government spending to get the economy going.
More government investment.
Whatever you want to call it. That's what George Bush did for the last 8 years. The budget
no, he didn't.
Domestic programs went through the roof.
But not investment programs. No, he cut money to education. Broadly speaking, inflation adjusted.
You just said that George Bush cut money for education. The education budget at the federal level doubled in the last 8 years. What cut are you talking about?
The vast majority of that money. Look at the last Congressional Budget Office study on the No Child Left Behind Act. We had an educational testing industry in the United States before No Child Left Behind that was worth about $300 million a year.
Right.
That was the entire industry. That's now a $4 billion a year industry. We had a huge transfer of money from the government sector to the private sector of guys who were cronies of Bush, and his brother Neil is one of them, you know, one of the guys who owns one of those companies. Stephen, you want to continue this on the other side of the break?
I'd be happy to. I'm having fun.
Okay, me too. Stephen Moore is with us. Opinionjournal.com is his website, or you can find his writings over there, formerly with the Club for Growth, et cetera. And then we'll pick up your call 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you here on Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Hartman here with you. Stephen Moore on the line with us, economist and policy analyst who founded and served as president of the Club for Growth from 1999 to 2004. Member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, senior economics writer at the Journal and also at opinionjournal.com. Stephen, it looks to me like we're looking at, if not the death of, certainly an extreme crisis for the middle class in America. And I would submit to you that we can track this right back to the Reagan tax cuts. We should repeal the Reagan tax cuts if we want to bring back manufacturing, if we want to bring back companies that are not operating in the interest of the short-term interests of shareholders rather than the long-term interests of the company and operating in the interest of the workers. Your response, sir.
Do you really think that we should go back to a 70% tax rate?
Yes, it worked very well for us in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s. We had strong, sustained growth during that period of time. Yeah.
I mean, I respect your opinion, but in my opinion, if we went anywhere near that, even if we went up to 40 or 50%, what you would see is, you know, you used the example of people reinvesting money in their companies at high tax rates. The problem is, well, that might have been the case in the 1970s. I don't think it was. But what would happen today, because we're living in a global marketplace, is that capital would leave the United States and everybody would invest everywhere but here. And so you would chase all the capital out of the U.S., and it would go to China, it would go to India, it would go to Germany, it would go to France, and you'd see a massive reduction in jobs.
I strongly disagree. Capital will go where there is an opportunity to build something to sell to people. As long as there is demand. As long as there's demand for products, there's going to be people who are going to satisfy that demand. And so,
but wait a minute. Think about what you just said, Tom. Think about a poor country like Bangladesh. There's a lot of demand for the problem in Bangladesh isn't that they don't have enough demand. I mean, they don't have.
Yes, it is. They have no wages.
Well, the
wages produce demand, Steve.
They don't have any supply.
No. I'm sorry. Wages are what produces demand. Supply is produced by productivity, but supply will only meet demand when demand can acquire supply, and that means wages. We have seen
Have you ever heard of something called Say's Law?
Yes.
Say's Law basically says that you can consume anything until someone produces something. I mean,
sure.
Keep it simple. Think if you're on a desert island. You can't consume anything on the desert island until you produce it.
That's
and
right.
So this idea that somehow demand produces supply. No, supply produces demand. You've got it backwards.
No, you know, go back to Adam Smith and the axe handle. I mean, you take a piece of wood and you put labor into it, and
right.
Now you have something of value. When that something
right.
of value is sold, then that labor is reimbursed. Then you have wages.
Right.
That wage then will produce more demand. Really what we're arguing is whether manufacturing or non-manufacturing industries are more efficient at creating wealth. But the bottom line is that supply is, in a supply-demand economy, supply is produced by productivity, demand is
right.
produced by wages, and we saw
right.
from 1791 with Hamilton's industrial policy up until the early 1980s, supply and demand pretty much tracking each other. And then in the 80s, when Reagan came in and dropped wages dramatically on the very wealthy and also started blowing open our borders, although Bill Clinton did the most of this damage, what we saw was that supply continued. In other words, productivity continued. We were still being more and more and more productive, but wages started to level off when Reagan declared war on working people in America, and the death of the middle class really began 26 years ago. And the thing that filled that gap between supply and demand, between wages and productivity, was debt. People went from owning their homes to using their homes as ATM. They went from owning their cars to renting their cars. And what we have now is the illusion of a middle class, but in fact, it's been hollowed out. It's dying.
Well, I agree with you that in the last year, the middle class has certainly taken a complete hit. There's no question about it. We've lost $7 trillion of wealth in this stock market collapse. But I don't think bashing businesses or bashing rich people is the way to get those jobs.
But the stock market collapse is the result of people speculating. And the reason that they're speculating is because you had these massive tax cuts that gave the people who had the money to speculate the incentive to speculate in the market with that money rather than to use that money to build productive businesses and keep that money within the company. Because if they didn't, they'd have to pay high income tax on it.
Answer me this then, Tom. I mean, why do you think it is, and there's a chapter in our book, The End of Prosperity, about this, that if you look all over the world, countries are cutting their tax rates. They're doing exactly what Reagan did. So France and Germany and Spain, Italy, China, India, all these countries are, and even Sweden, by the way, which is the most socialistic country in the world, 2 weeks ago it cut its corporate income tax. And the reason they're all doing this is because we're all chasing after investment capital, and investment capital flows to wherever it's treated most kindly. And so you can't, there's no way America can compete with a 35% corporate tax rate when you can go to other countries and get 5 or 10%.
And what is, and I'll tell you, Stephen, what's going to happen is in these countries, if, first of all, most of these tax cuts are fairly modest. You're talking about, you know, cutting from 65% down to 61% or 58%. But if anybody imitates Thatcher and Reagan, then that country 10, 20 years down the road is going to see the exact result that we're seeing as a consequence of Reaganomics and Thatcheronomics, which is bubbles and busts.
What about Ireland? Do you know the Ireland story?
Yeah, I know it well.
Ireland is like one of the greatest economic success stories over the last 20 years.
And the main reason is because they provide free education to anybody in Ireland. Yeah,
they
investing.
And also, you know what else they do? They cut their corporate tax rate from 48% to 12%.
But they actually collect it, whereas we don't in the United States. Steve,
well, that's true, too.
Okay, Stephen Moore, OpinionJournal.com, his new book, The End of Prosperity. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Tom. Talk to you soon.
Yep.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Hey, Mr. President, I don't think I'd want your job. I can barely handle the simple one I got. Hey, Mr. President, how cool is Air Force One? Are those guys in the House and the Senate ever gonna get anything done? I ain't no Democrat, I ain't no Republican. We're fathers and mothers, we're wives and husbands, and we pray that we dance at our daughters' weddings, and our sons grow to fine men, and for peace on our land.
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And our Higgins Alert for the day. Oh, my God. We're talking seriously overweight cats. Yes, I have one. And in the UK, they are having a competition for what cat can lose the most money. Seriously, a nationwide competition. You see the picture of this cat this woman is holding. This is like a 100-pound cat or something like this. Thousands of cats and dogs all over the country. They're putting them on a diet and... seems like the sort of thing that a dog food company should do. I'm not sure it's the best use of government resources, but it's an interesting one. Okay, here's the bottom line. The middle class in the United States is facing a real crisis. 76% of American middle class households are not financially secure. 76%. 4 million, during the years of the Bush administration, 4 million middle class families dropped out of the middle class, became the working poor. 23 million are economically insecure. In other words, they're literally 6 to 8 weeks away from disaster if they lose a paycheck or get ill. And the number's frankly probably much larger than that, but that's a very conservative number from the study done by Demos. You can find it over at demos.org. 4 million American households lost economic security between 2000 and 2006. The median financial assets held by middle-class families between 2000 and 2006 declined by 22%. People, in order to maintain some semblance, some appearance of a middle-class lifestyle, people have turned their homes into ATM machines. They've stopped owning their cars and driving them into the ground and instead are renting them. Their equity, their real wealth is vanishing. We saw last year, for the first time since the Great Depression, actual negative savings, negative net savings in the United States, 1/2 of 1%. In other words, not only were people not saving money, they were broadly going in debt. 30 years ago, the average American had zero on their credit cards. Today, it's over $7,000 for the average American family. Money on their credit, debt on their credit card. 30, 40 years ago, you couldn't even get a credit card unless you could, you know, prove that you could easily pay it off. And if you carried any kind of a balance, it was considered, oh, that's a problem. That's a real problem. I mean, we've gone nuts. We have gone nuts. And why? In part because of the Reagan tax cuts, in part because of the insane trade policies that we've seen in the United States over the last 30 years, where we've said, yeah, hey, you know, if you want to make something in China where the labor costs one-tenth of what it costs here, if you want to make it in the Philippines, if you want to make it in Mexico, no problem. We don't need no stinking middle class in the United States. Let's just arbitrage labor. Let's make labor something that is a commodity as easily bought or sold as iron ore or cotton. And the consequence of that has been millions and millions of manufacturing jobs leaving this country. And the only real way you produce wealth is with manufacturing. You know, a service economy is a secondary economy. It's not a real economy. I'll wash your car if you'll mow my lawn. I'm sorry. Neither one of us are producing wealth. We're exchanging money. We're getting something done, but we're not producing wealth. When you convert raw materials into finished goods, you're producing wealth. You're making something. We don't make anything in this country anymore. And it's because of 26, 28 years of insane economic policies. Bottom line, period, insane economic policies. The housing burdened, in other words, people who are at risk of losing their homes, rose from 31% in 2000 to 37% in 2006. Monthly housing expenses for the middle class during just this last 6 years have increased by 9%. We're seeing basically the death of what we used to call the American dream, becoming middle class. You know, before the 80s, the American dream was, I want to be a middle class guy. I want to be able to put my kids through school. I want to be able to buy a house, you know, and have it paid off by the end of my life so I've got something to pass along to my family or there's some assets. I want to have enough money in my pension that I can live in my old age and provide for my family. I want to be able to have health care throughout all the way to the end of my life. I mean, that was the American middle class dream. And when Reagan came into office and 25% of our workforce was unionized, which meant 50% of our workforce had that as its baseline for labor, because every union job produces an equivalent job in the marketplace because it sets the floor for labor. We had about half the American workforce with a single income able to actually support a family and have that living wage that the first President Roosevelt talked about back in 1908, that Teddy talked about. And now, after 26 years of war on the middle class and conservative economic policies that basically say, sorry, Charlie, you're on your own, we're down to 8% of the private workforce being unionized and 16 to 20% of the American workforce being able to raise a family on a single income. And half of all children in this country come home to an empty home. That's not the American dream. And what happened in the 1980s is somehow we recalibrated the American dream. The whole Reagan greed is good era said, you know, the American dream, it's not that middle class thing. The American dream is getting rich. You know, it's being Gordon Gekko. It's being a master of the universe. I'm sorry, that's not the American dream. The American dream is to have, with a high school education, ideally, you know, if you do what is expected of you in society, you live a decent job, you go to work, you're a good parent to your kids. The American dream is to be able to live a decent life, die a death with dignity and pass something along. It's not to become Sam Walton. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with becoming Sam Walton, but the American dream has always been, all the way back to the founding of this country. Go back in 1836, Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America. Read it. Read the writings of Jefferson, Madison, the founders of this country. None of them were, in today's dollars, multimillionaires. Some of them had a lot of land. But, I mean, you know, Jefferson died bankrupt. Washington died virtually bankrupt. He didn't have enough money to free all his slaves, and he desperately wanted to. These guys didn't leave fortunes. They weren't trying to create a nation of selfish libertarians who said, oh, it's just all about me. No, they said, we the people, the first three words of the preamble of the Constitution. So, anyhow, enough rant. 866-303-2270 is our telephone number. AC, is that Armin in Bradenton, Florida? Hey, Armin, listening on WINS. What's up?
Sometime I want to meet you in person because you and me are so close to being true 100% brothers.
You got it, Armin. What's up?
You just remind me of a buddy I grew up with, really, Tom. I don't know why, but well, he was one of my best friends.
Thank you.
Anyway, in defense of your point of view, I wish I could have had a bug in your ear like they had for Bush during his debates and said, when Mr. Moore was on, I've seen him on TV a lot. He's very educated, but I think he's off the tracks. Because Reagan, the biggest thing that really made Reagan look better than he really was is he had a blank check.
That's right. And during that time, I was running around saying, you know, everybody's saying, oh, look at the economy. It's so great. Reagan took us from a $1 trillion debt to a $4 trillion debt. And I said, you give me a $3 trillion credit card, I'll make it. I'll show you what it looks like to live large.
You can make anything look good if you have a blank check.
And Bush has been doing it for the last 8 years. You're absolutely right, Armin. And that is one of the big problems. And oddly enough, that's probably one of the areas where Stephen Moore and many of the conservatives out there and libertarians of goodwill, I mean, you know, who seriously understand how things work. And I agree, you know, oddly enough. Brian, and thanks for the call, Armin. Great to hear from you. Brian in Redondo Beach, California, listening to K-Talk in
good
L.A.
Morning,
hey, Brian. What's
up?
Good
morning, Tom. I could not wait until I got home today because I've been working day shift and night shift, going back and forth. But make a quick story short, the guy who was just on, I disagreed with him one thing, because the voucher, I've had cousins. I was born and raised in L.A. Mm-hmm. I have cousins who had traveled to school 2 hours a day, going to school, and then 2 hours back home. And by the time they get home, they're tired.
Right.
That's not a fair thing. I think what's fair, what President-elect Obama wants to do is get rid of those things and fix the schools. Let's fix the schools in the rural areas. Let's fix the schools in the city, and let's start. Let's get some good people going. So I have friends like him, and they were Republicans before they got hold of me, and they voted for Obama. Because I think it's foolish that we are not letting our kids go to school and don't even care about our kids going to school.
And we should be just like Germany and France and the United Kingdom and Sweden and Switzerland and you know, right across the board, we should be saying, yes, we not only are we going to invest in our kids up to the age of, you know, 16, 18, we're going to invest all the way through because it is an investment. You're absolutely right. Evan in Olympia, we got a minute before the break, Evan. You wanted to disagree with me.
Yeah, Tom, good to hear you again. You know, I always love to talk to you. I think this whole thing has to also take into account economies of scale. You see, when you have a really big company, then you have more room to be able to make those profits and hoard them. But when you're a really small manufacturing company, you're getting squeezed on the cost of doing business to this point between, you know, the taxes that you pay, the commodities you need to make.
Evan, I have owned small manufacturing companies, and we never paid any taxes. What you do is you make sure by the end of the year that you're investing in new equipment, that you don't have money left over.
Well, that's a great idea, Tom, but it's like, you know,
you pay salaries.
Just don't have that extra room. If you're not making
wait a minute, Evan. If you're complaining that a small business is paying taxes, what you're saying is that small business is profitable. If they're profitable, what's wrong with them paying taxes? I guess we don't have an answer. Anyhow, Evan, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, that's the bottom line. Is small businesses, if you've got a lot of money left over at the end of the year, hey, you can reinvest it in the company and you can build that company and you can build America, or you can take it as pay and you can pay taxes on it. But, you know, either one is fine, but, you know, fair is fair. Wait, do away with taxes? Come on.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Save us from the lies. Save our homes from foreclosing. Stop treating us as spies. Save our jobs from leaving. Bring back made in USA. Represent the ones who made you, not the ones who pave your way.
Yeah, how about bringing back made in USA? You know, why is it that if you want to sell something into Japan, that you have to pay an import tariff? If you want to sell something into South Korea, you have to pay an import tariff. In some of those countries, you even have to have a certain amount of domestic content, or you have to have a local partner. If you want to sell something into China, you have to pay an import tariff. If you want to sell something into Peru, you have to pay an import tariff. If you want to sell something into Brazil or Argentina, you have to pay an import tariff, because they're protecting their manufacturers. But if somebody wants to sell something in the United States, hey, our doors are open. So the consequence of that is all of this so-called free trade, 40%. And this statistic is actually a couple years old. I haven't seen an update on it recently. I guarantee it's higher than 40% now. 40% of international trade in and out of the United States is done within individual countries. In other words, it's a company in the United States, you know, Dell making computers or Hewlett-Packard making printers or whatever, not to pick on these particular companies. Everybody's doing it. It's not like bad companies. It's bad rules. Hewlett-Packard saying, okay, yeah, we're going to sell printers in the United States. Let's make them in China and sell them to ourselves. 40% of all our trade is companies selling to themselves so that they can import things into the United States. That's arbitrage of labor, nothing more. And that is destroying the middle class in the United States as well. In fact, I'd say that's one of the number one things destroying the middle class in the United States. Joe in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, you're on the air. Thanks for listening to KPHX there in Phoenix. What's up, Joe?
Hello?
Hey, Joe. You're on.
Oh, okay. You know, I was just calling about the comments you made on Charles Dickens. You know, and you said there was like 5% middle class, 5%, you know, upper class, and 90% lower class, the working poor. But, you know, I'm writing this paper out at ASU, and I'm kind of finding out that, you know, there was more of a rising middle class during the, you know, Victorian period.
Yes,
and I was just wondering about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, what you saw during the, particularly the latter years of the Victorian period and throughout Europe as well, was that there was a growth in the middle class, and it was in large part because Britain was brutally enforcing an industrial policy. They said to India, for example, it is fine for you to grow cotton. You may grow cotton. Please grow cotton. We need cotton to fuel the factories in the United Kingdom where we make clothing, which we sell all over the world. But it is illegal for you in India to spin that cotton into cloth, into thread, to weave that thread into cloth or to make that cloth into clothing. That's why Mahatma Gandhi's logo was a spinning wheel. It was a crime. You would go to prison if you made clothing in India when the British controlled it during the Victorian era. And that's how Great Britain got rich. And that's how many countries, many industrialized countries get rich, is by keeping their supply companies, or countries rather, the third world countries, keeping them as nothing more than suppliers of raw materials in the case of Great Britain and India, they actually had laws that made it illegal to make clothing. Now, the way that other countries have done it is simply using tariffs, you know, and that's how we did it. And Friedrich List in 1848 wrote a brilliant book on this topic, pointing out that the whole idea of free trade is nonsense. And he coined this phrase, kicking away the ladder. And he said, what a country does when it reaches the point that the UK had during the Victorian era, when you're importing all these raw materials and then you're forcing those people that are selling you the raw materials to be the customers for your finished goods. In other words, they're supporting your manufacturing base, is you kick away the ladder so they can't climb the same ladder you did. And the way you do that is by putting import tariffs on manufactured goods and export tariffs on raw materials. And that's what the UK had done. That's what we did for years. That's what Japan does. It's what China does. It's what South Korea has done. And frankly, it's rational policy. Where it gets irrational is when you do it the way the UK did at that time with India. You enforce it as law. Instead, enforce it as an economic policy and let every country around the world do that. And then you'll have what Adam Smith talked about, which is where those countries that have a natural advantage, or as David Ricardo referred to, a comparative advantage, those countries that have a natural advantage in a particular area will prosper in that area. So, you know, in Smith's example from Wealth of Nations, you got a country that has a natural, you know, it's naturally easy to have sheep live there. That country is going to make a lot of sweaters and they're going to do well making sweaters. You got another country where it's easy to grow grapes. That country is going to have a great wine industry. You have a third country where it's easy to grow cows and make cheese. You have a good cheese industry. All three of those companies can trade with each other, you know, without a lot of tariffs, and everybody gets wine, cheese, and gets to sit around wearing a sweater. But if two of those three countries can make cheese, then it becomes incumbent on those two countries to start protecting their cheese industry, or there's only going to be, you know, one's going to wipe out the other. And you know, that's kind of Econ 101, and that's what happened during the Victorian era, Joe. Thanks for the call. It's a good one. I really appreciate opportunities to rant on this stuff. David in Coral Springs, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, David.
How you doing?
Good. What's up?
My girlfriend turned me on your show when we first started dating 3 months ago, and I've listened to it every chance since then, and I've gotten.
Thank you.
I love your definition of the libertarians as people who want to get laid and smoke dope. And after listening to the libertarian guy that you had on and the conservative guy that you had on after him, I need to go out and smoke dope and get laid. First of all, you were just talking about the middle class. I am not middle class. I have been fortunate to come from a family that lived the American dream. My father was an immigrant, built his own company, was able to educate me. I made a life for myself. I own my own company. I am not middle class. I am, by any stretch of the imagination, well off.
Mm-hmm.
With that said, I would make the comment that the middle class has no one to blame for their current situation but themselves. They signed the pink slip to their country over to rich people. Giving money to rich people to make them richer has not worked. It was a fallacy from the very first.
But see, it was sold to them with a multi-hundred million dollar advertising campaign. When Joe Coors and Richard Mellenscaife endowed the Heritage Foundation, when these guys started the Libertarians started the Cato Institute, they and the corporate media in this country, and Clinton sold this too. I mean, I'll lay this at his feet step in an instant. Robert Rubin, the whole gang of them, they sold this, and the average person just wants to work. I mean, they're not economic policy wonks. They just want to work. So I think that we're blaming the victim here.
But they bought into it by voting for these idiots.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right, and they did, and that's why we need to wake up.
The one thing I would add to your libertarian comment was, in addition to wanting to smoke dope and get laid, they don't want to pay taxes.
Yeah,
we are the only industrialized country in the world that can't provide our people with health care.
You're right. Well said. David, I gotta take a break here, but thank you very much for the call. Well said. Yeah, that's why I say libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. God bless them. 57 minutes past the hour. Kerry Lucas coming up next.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Kerry Lucas is on the line with us. She's the Vice President for Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org. One of our favorite conservative guests. Hey, Kerry, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me back on.
I always have a lot of fun talking with you and getting your thoughts on things. Here's my take on how we need to save the middle class, Kerry. First of all, will you agree with broadly, and I realize how dangerous it might be for you to agree with anything I say, but will you agree with my assertion that the middle class in America is facing a crisis right now?
Sure, absolutely. I think a lot of people have looked at their retirement savings going down and they're struggling with home prices. Absolutely. I think a lot of people personally feel like they're in crisis.
Okay, so we have a minimum wage right now that is bupkis. Why don't we raise the minimum wage to $13 or $14 an hour, which is where it would be if wages had increased at the same rate that productivity has since 1980.
Well, you know, Tom, I think that, you know, obviously we all wish that salaries could be higher and that people could be making more money. But obviously there's a trade-off when it comes to how much we pay people to how much money companies have or businesses have to hire workers. So what we've seen with minimum wage laws in the past is that, yes, some people are made better off when you jack up their salaries, but that money has to come from somewhere, and unfortunately a lot of it ends up coming from other people's jobs, and we see job loss. And I think particularly in this economy...
Kerry, that's never been demonstrated. Pardon me for interrupting you, but I can cite you a half a dozen studies that show that every time the minimum wage goes up, GDP actually goes up and job growth increases. I don't know of any that demonstrate. I mean, it seems kind of logical that if employers have to pay more money to people, that they would maybe lay off some people. But it's not the case.
Well, you know, I think, you know, we've talked about this before, how we can toss back competing studies. But you know, I was looking at some research today and was looking at a study that just came out by a professor from American and Cornell. And what they're really lamenting, and, you know, I don't think these guys are necessarily conservatives. They basically end by talking about if we really want to try to alleviate poverty, they want to expand the EITC, because their thoughts are just that it's such a poorly targeted. This doesn't help poor people necessarily. A lot of the minimum wage earners are second and third earners, so a lot of teenagers, a lot of spouses, and while we may, of course, hope for them to make more money too, in terms of really alleviating financial, those who are suffering the most, it's not a very well targeted policy.
10% of our adult workforce is earning the minimum wage right now in the United States, 13 million workers.
Sure.
I mean, that's not an insignificant number. And when you look, if you were to simply take the minimum wage from 1979 to today, just from 1979, from the year before Reagan came into office to today, the minimum wage in real dollars is 19% lower than it was when Reagan came into office. And now, I haven't seen an explosion in jobs as a consequence of that.
Well, we need to be careful because obviously the United States has had incredible job growth. We are a growing country. We take in millions and millions of more people each year, and we have had low unemployment for decades now. And we kind of take for granted that our economy does keep generating jobs. Right now we've had a real uptick in unemployment, and that's a reason for concern. But that's why more than ever we need to be careful because, you know, okay, so some studies haven't been able to correlate with there's so much going on in the economy. It's hard to isolate just one policy's effect on something like jobs, but we do know it's rational. It's economists across the board understand that, or else, Tom, if there's really no relationship between salaries and the number of jobs we're going to have, well, then why stop at $12, or, you know, Barack Obama has a proposal for $9.50. You know, you might support a living wage, which is $12-$13 an hour or something.
Yep.
But if it really has no relationship to jobs, then why stop there? If there's no cost to it, then let's go up to $100 an hour.
That's irrational. I mean, the rationale for a minimum wage is real simple, and that is that we have that having a middle class in America is a desirable thing because it's an essential precondition for democracy, number one, which is something that the founders asserted over and over again. I mean, Alexis de Tocqueville wrote an entire book about it in 1836 called Democracy in America. So, number one, we want to have a middle class in the United States, a healthy one. And there's a social good for us all in that, and a political good. Number two, that the economy is here to serve we the people, not we the people are here to serve the owners of the economy. So if the premise of a minimum wage is that if a company cannot afford to pay somebody a living wage, they have no damn right to be doing business in this country. It's not a company that's viable by definition, because we want, you know, viable companies, that is companies that serve the public interest as well as make a profit, then the minimum wage should be a living wage. Otherwise, if you accept the notion, which I think you're putting forward, that there should be no involvement by the government in the economy, then there should be no minimum wage whatsoever. Are you arguing for no minimum wage or for the current minimum wage?
Well, you know, I definitely think that there's problems with having any minimum wage, because what my belief is that people have a right to make decisions about their own lives. And if I'm willing to go out and work, if I want to work for somebody, for an employer who's only able to pay me $5 an hour instead of $8 or whatever it is now, that should be my right. And that's what I think that it always
surprises me. You should have the right to live in poverty.
Good, absolutely. If I have a right to a job, to make decisions for myself, if two consenting adults want to exchange an hour of my time for $5 instead of $8, who is the government to tell me that's illegal?
Absolutely, Carrie.
Absolutely.
I totally agree with you that if we're talking about a contractual agreement between consenting adults in a world where there is a variety of options, fine. You know, if somebody wants to work for $3 an hour, let them work for $3 an hour. But if the only jobs out there are $3 an hour, I would suggest to you that the worker in that case is not making a consensual agreement, that they simply have no choice, that is a modified version of slavery.
But, you know, I think that one of the things that's kind of funny in this argument is that so often the minimum wage increases don't have a real impact, because actually wages have increased on their own above what the government has mandated. So a lot of times you'll find people saying, oh, well, we can move it up because it's already moved up. Almost all jobs already are paying this much anyway. Well, that may be a reason in some people's mind that government should, but then I think it's a reason why they shouldn't, because obviously there are a lot of jobs out there that are paying more than minimum wage. But a lot of people need that first job that pays not so much so that they can get some skills so they can be worth $10 an hour.
So are you suggesting that having a strong middle class is not essential to democracy?
No, of course not. I mean,
then how are you going to have a strong middle class if everybody has to work for for so little money that they literally can't afford health care or become
whether or not government has a regulation or not doesn't change people's skills and people's level of productivity. What you're saying is that you think government has to go out there and mandate what type of jobs people can offer. You're going
to cut out
a whole class of jobs by saying something that's worth under $12 to an employer is no longer going to be an option.
I am not saying that. When John McCain offered $50 an hour to pick lettuce in Arizona, he had over 10,000 people apply for the job. Remember? He said, you know, the reason that we've got to have cheap labor picking, or we've got to have Hispanics in Arizona picking lettuce is because Americans won't do the job. I mean, setting aside the racist subtext to that, you know, that was his statement, and 10,000 white Americans, you know, Americans from all over America said, hey, $50 an hour, I'll pick lettuce.
But is he going to make money? Is anyone who's going to go out there and pay, you know, I think that lettuce farmer who goes out there and starts offering $50 a head for people to pick lettuce for an hour, they're going to be going out of business very, very quickly. So
you're right. It's an extreme example, and it's an absurd example. But the reality is that I would be perfectly willing to pay 20% more for pretty much everything in my life if my paycheck is 40% larger. Because the wage increase is only a small piece of the overall economy, and it's not going to be a 100% concordance between wage increases and price increases.
But there, I mean, I think that when it comes to mandating wages, to saying that some people are going to be making more, it still comes down to this idea that somebody's going to end up making less. Businesses, it's not these people. If everybody just gets a 20% increase in wages, that doesn't mean their productivity is going to go up.
No, their productivity is already very high.
But I don't understand where you think this new money is going to come from, where you're going to get your 40% more if you're paying people 20% more.
What I'm saying is that we should say to businesses in this country, if you can't conduct yourself in a way that you can pay a living wage, you have no right doing business. Figure it out.
I think it seems kind of strange, first of all, that we're going to dictate to people whether or not they can open a business. If they're not good enough, you know, the market is going to tell them. We don't need to sit there and say, if you can't pay people this much or if you can't do business the way we think you should do business, I don't know. That just seems very big brother government to me.
Okay, I'll leave you with the last word. Thanks so much for being with us, Carrie.
Thank you.
Carrie Lucas with the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Let's put Congress on the minimum wage and see how long they can last. Let them try to rely on the minimum wage and see them change it, rearrange it, wow, real fast. And when they say that the pay makes it tough to survive, we're telling them, hey, it keeps you alive. When they cry that they try, but they can't get ahead, we'll send a social worker to pat them on the head. They'd be poor, but I'm sure it would be all the rage if we put Congress on the minimum wage.
There's a plan for you. Put Congress on the minimum wage. I'm telling you, the minimum wage would sure go up fast. Okay, here's the deal. We have to have a middle class in the United States if we're going to have a functional democracy. This is you look around the world. Okay, we went to Iraq, which, by the way, 20 years ago had a middle class more or less. But, you know, let's not get into that debate. We went to Iraq and we bombed them basically back to the Stone Age. And now they don't have reliable water. They don't have reliable electricity. They don't have a functioning middle class. And we think they're going to have a functioning democracy? It ain't going to happen. You can't. I mean, look at any country in the world. You cannot have a functioning small-d democracy or a republic, if you want to use the Republican talking points that we should call this a republic rather than a democracy because it sounds more like Republican. You can't have a functioning democratic republic without a functioning middle class. It's just that simple. So how do you achieve that? Because a middle class is not a normal thing. It requires intervention in the marketplace. What is normal is for there to be a small, and going all, it goes 7,000 years ago for, you know, in Sumeria with Gilgamesh, all the way up to today. What is normal is that there is a small, very wealthy elite, there is a small mercantile middle class, and there is a large class of the working poor. That is what's normal. And you can look at most of the economies around the world that are so-called free market economies. We refer to them as third world countries. And that's what you'll see, because that's what laissez-faire capitalism, absolutely unregulated libertarian capitalism, that's what it will always produce. It'll destroy the middle class, other than the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, the few folks who own their own small businesses and the family farm. That's it. And everybody else is the working poor. So how do you build a middle class? There's only two ways. One is you limit the supply of labor. This is what happened after the Black Death in the 1400s. And a middle class emerged because a third of Europe died off. It's a lousy way to do it, but it's what happened. It was called the Renaissance. People had time on their hands. A middle class emerged. Another is that you massively and dramatically increase the wealth of the country. England did this with their policies relative to India that we were talking about in the last hour. Most of Europe did this by robbing, raping, and pillaging North America and South and Central and South America, in particular, all that gold that the Spanish took in the 16th and 17th centuries. And it raised the wealth level in Europe to the point where a middle class emerged. And you had the second great middle class in Europe. It was called the Enlightenment. And then that middle class kind of went away. And then the third way to make a middle class is what Franklin Roosevelt came up with, what John Maynard Keynes came up with, which is to say the purpose of an economy is to serve the people, not the other way around. And so you have to have, it's just like a football game. You know, the purpose of a football game is to play a football game. And so you have rules. You have very specific rules. And a football game is not a soccer game, and it's not a baseball game. It's got its own specific rules. And so you create the rules of an economy that say basically the first goal of this economy is to help create a middle class. So we're going to allow unionization. In fact, we're going to encourage it. We're going to have a minimum wage. We're going to say to companies, you know, if you're not going to pay at least a decent wage, you have no right to be doing business in our economy. We're going to protect our domestic economy with tariffs and so-called protectionist measures to keep domestic manufacture in this country. And we're going to stop compensating CEOs with stock so they start thinking like, as they have been for the last 26 years, and this is what's wrong with Detroit, because they're so highly compensated with stock rather than with paychecks. They're behaving like stockholders. They're thinking what's best for the next quarter, what's best for the next 6 months, what's best for the next year. Well, what's best for the next year is to make great big cars that are very profitable. It's not the best thing for the company, not the best thing for the long run, but it's the best thing for the stockholders. And when you turn senior executives into stockholders and you cause them to start thinking like stockholders, they start behaving stupid. And that's what we've seen with the big three, among others. So anyhow, in today's Financial Times here, Henry Paulson's off to China. And he's been the headline, Paulson in last stand against weaker the currency in China. China, this is an example, again, how, you know, China is building a middle class, actually, by protecting their domestic economy. And they're using trade legislation to do it to a large extent. By sacrificing trade legislation, what we've done is we've said we're going to do this instead with what's called monetary policy. We're going to drive down the value of the dollar, drive up the value of other currencies, and therefore it'll be more expensive to import things, and therefore there will be an incentive for domestic manufacture. The problem is it's like trying to attack a fly with a shotgun rather than a fly swatter. I mean, it's because it changes the entire spectrum of goods that are being made. So Paulson's going over to China to beg the Chinese not to change the value of their currency relative to the dollar, knowing that if they do, you know, the Chinese goods could become even cheaper in the United States, which is going to destroy even more of our jobs because we're relying on a stupid monetary policy as a way of regulating trade rather than a trade policy that says, as it did from 1791 until the 1980s, here's 22,000 different items that we're going to have specific tariffs on. I mean, this is, China's getting it. They're building a middle class. We're destroying ours.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Yeah. Can you feel me near you? Yeah, I'm right here. Tommy, can you see me? Just take a look at that Tom Vision thing there. You can see it over at AirAmerica.com. Downright strange stuff, downright crazy stuff going on in the world. Yeah, maybe we're totally crazy. I don't know. This poor guy, Giovanni De Stefano from Palermo, Italy. He's 82 years old. He takes some Viagra, and his wife calls the police. She's freaked out. She says, he's so excited, he's going to have a heart attack. Please stop him from taking Viagra. Oh, now he's in the newspaper. That'll probably give him a heart attack. Who knows? Anyhow, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. By the way, I just want to shout out to the folks from ABC's 2020, John Stossel and his company and crew. I'll be over at his place tonight. I don't know. We'll see what happens with that. Chris Kilmer, Russ Maho, and Fred Weil hanging out here, taking pictures, doing the audio, producing John's show. And generating some B-roll. We're having a good time. It's some good people to hang out with. 866-303-20. And thank you, guys. You're good. Good to work with. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Will in Easton, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing? That woman you were just debating with, I know you have her on a lot. I'm so glad you talk about this subject, because this to me is probably the great undiscussed subject in the United States. How basically there is this obvious war that's going on against people that are, you know, not super rich. My analogy that she drew that I think is comparable to what she said about, oh, I want to have a right to live in poverty. Well, then if she wants to claim that right, then I want to have a right to shoot someone in the head to take their money. I don't mean to sound violent. I'm just saying.
I think you're pushing the limits of A equals B here, Will.
Do you really think so?
Yeah. There are some people who will choose to live in poverty, and they should have the right to make that choice. I mean, you know, there are monks who take vows of poverty, for example. The right to harm another person, I don't think that's a parallel right. I don't have a good analogy for you.
I don't mean to apply that. Like, what I'm getting at is that it is not a right. No one chooses that right except for monks. That is a barbaric way to think. It's so self-indulgent.
Well,
all I'm saying.
You know, I get it. And well said, Will. Here's the problem. Here's where it's coming from. There is this religion. And it's really a religion, because it's a belief system that's not based on evidence. In fact, it contradicts evidence in most cases. And it's a utopian belief system. It's one of those belief systems that starts out with the phrase, if only everybody did, right? And the libertarian, conservative, you know, there's different flavors of it. Objectivist, you know, we have the folks from the Ayn Rand Institute on the show frequently. There's this belief system that if only everybody only behaved in their own personal self-interest, that would create a universal self-interest that would work. Alan Greenspan believed this. And in fact, just, you know, a couple of weeks ago came out and said, I guess I was wrong. You know, he said it never occurred to him that people, when they get together and work at the level of an institution, might behave in a way that wasn't in the self-interest of everybody, even though it was in their own self-interest. So, you know, the folks like Carrie, and I'm reluctant even to characterize her when she's not here to defend herself. But the worldview that suggests that is a worldview that actually is trying for the best. I mean, these are people who truly believe that they're creating a better world. The problem is that evidence doesn't support that their techniques work.
Right. It's a very naive notion of the world.
Yeah.
People left to their own devices are going to be by nature very selfish, and that's the problem.
It works out, yeah. Well, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Steve in Hillsboro, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Steve.
Hey, you are familiar with the Laffer curve, correct?
Yeah, in fact, I had Arthur Laffer on the show about 3 weeks ago, trying to defend it.
I truly believe that Reagan misapplied the Laffer curve as an excuse to lower the top tax rate to beyond the point of increasing returns.
Yes. Yeah, if there was some truth to the Laffer curve, it probably stopped being true around the 50% top marginal rate on people making over $3.2 million a year, which used to be the old threshold. But I would argue that there's not even any truth to the Laffer curve, because it's predicated on the assumption that if people are facing, after that $3.2 million on which they're paying a relatively low income tax, if they then are facing a high income tax beyond that, that they're going to stop being productive. And I would submit to you that 90% of people who are certainly in that income category are there because they're doing something they love, and they'll continue doing it, as they did in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the early 1980s. People didn't stop working just because they hit the 90% income tax bracket, number one. So it's not going to harm productivity, as Arthur Laffer said. And number two, what it is going to do, what high income taxes do, and what we've seen, you see it in every country in Europe, and we saw it in the United States during the 40 years that we had high top marginal tax rates in the United States. Now, I'm not talking about taxes on the middle class. This builds a middle class, the taxes on the rich. I'm not talking about high taxes on the middle class, but when you have high taxes on the very wealthy, it gives them an incentive to keep the money in the companies and to pay better salaries to the middle class. High marginal tax rates on the wealthy produce and strengthen the middle class in America.
Definitely true on the last part. But let's assume that Laffer is correct and shoot for the 50%.
Okay.
that you mentioned, and put the top tax rate at 50%, and
which is what LBJ, which is roughly what LBJ did, by the way.
What?
Actually, it was Reagan who took it to 50%. LBJ dropped it down to 70%. But yeah, okay, your point.
If we do tax the top at 50% without deductions,
right.
Their salary, their income is taxed at 50%.
Right. Your point, Steve.
You could probably drop the bottom rate to 0% for anybody making less than $500,000.
Well, I don't know about $500,000, but I would guess that you could get a zero tax rate for anybody making under $35,000 or $40,000, which is basically what it used to be. I mean, when the income tax was introduced in 1913, only the top 1% of wage earners were paying that 1% tax. I mean, it was a very, very limited tax. And for much of the history of the income tax, it was a very limited tax. And to the extent that, I love to disagree with Stephen Moore, but he did make a good point on our show earlier, and that is that the inflation of the 70s pushed a lot of working people into higher tax brackets, who frankly before that weren't paying taxes or were paying much lower taxes, and that was a tax in the middle class. Now, I can also build a case for you if you want. This is something that I learned the week that we did our show in Denmark in June, sitting and talking with several Danish legislators and the equivalent of the Danish vice president, is that when taxes on working people on the middle class go up, when income taxes on the middle class go up, assuming that they're getting some value for it, in this case it was 2 years of unemployment benefits, free college education, free national health care plans. Things like that, good infrastructure. 30% of the people in Copenhagen bicycle to work because there's a huge bicycle. When the middle class has a tax increase, say their tax goes from 30 to 40%, what happens is their wages go up because they will work. I mean, if say your paycheck is $50,000 a year and you're paying a 50% tax rate, so you're taking home $25,000 a year, and your boss knows you're willing to work for $25,000 a year. What happens if your taxes are cut in half? So instead of paying a 50% tax rate, you're paying a 25% tax rate. Now you're taking home in the neighborhood of $35,000 a year, right? $33,000, $34,000 a year. Your boss knows you'll work for only $25,000. What's he going to do? He's going to cut your wages. If your taxes are cut, if taxes on working people are cut, wages will go down. And that's exactly what we've seen in the United States over the last 26 years. Every time taxes got cut on working people, on the middle class, wages went down. Because employers know, hey, these people are paying less taxes, they're willing to work for less, net-net, so we're going to lower their pay. On the other hand, when taxes on the middle class go up, wages go up. And because working people, they have a certain threshold. I've got to make this. This is the nut that I've got to make. I got to pay my mortgage. I got to pay for the car. I got to pay for the food. Now, it's a completely different equation when you're talking about the top 5%, the wealthy people. When you're talking about people who 100% of their income does not get spent every year, but instead a large portion of their income gets invested or saved, it's a whole different ballgame. For them, when their tax rate goes down, they simply have more money to save and stash away. And when their tax rate goes up, they have less money to stash or save away. And if they own a business, more incentive to plow that money back into the business. So the argument that's made for higher and lower taxes is true in as much as, you know, it's taking money away from people or it's giving money to people. It's true if you're rich. It's not true if you're a working person. And the experience both in the United States and of every country in the world bears this out. And so anyhow, if you want to have a strong middle class, you want to have that, you know, as Roosevelt talked about, he said, you know, a necessitous man is not a free man. You want to have free people. You want to have a strong middle class of free people. There has to be a fundamental social safety net through which they will not fall. Otherwise, they won't take chances. I started several businesses in my life on nothing. And if I had not been successful in those businesses, I would have been broke and homeless. And, you know, thank God I was successful and did very well. But I took those chances because I knew that something would catch me if I fell. That, you know, I had friends, I had, you know, social structure, I had, you know, whatever. And by changing our bankruptcy laws now, so it's harder to declare bankruptcy, we've done away with part of that social safety net, and by the high cost of health care, we're wiping it out.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. No, it's not. I'm looking at the wrong clock here. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And our Grinch alert. I'm sorry, I don't have a Grinch liner for you here. Just imagine the, you're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. Has the recession made a Grinch of IKEA? The furniture giant is now selling reindeer meat, and Rudolph is not put down kindly. Animal rights activists are charging that IKEA's reindeer slices and reindeer salami are products of animal cruelty. IKEA answers, hey, we hunt them with helicopters. Isn't that just fine? And animal rights activists say, no, don't think so. We report, you decide. Ellen Ratner on the line with us for the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, what is the state of the middle class in America?
I don't know. You're the expert on that point, but it isn't good.
It isn't good. Yeah, I'll tell you, it isn't. And so, what's going on in Washington D.C.?
Well, we've got some statistics out. The retailers are saying they had very poor sales in November. They have a sales drop of 2.7% for November. Mortgage rates have dropped, of course, and the Fed is thinking about dropping them down to 4.5%, but only for new mortgages. Factory orders went down in October, 5.1% in 1 month.
Whoa. You know, this is,
in
aggregate, Ellen, this stuff is called deflation. And the last time we had deflation in the United States, we called it the Republican Great Depression of the 1929 to 1939 period.
Right. And remember that after 29, what, stocks didn't go up till 1952 to where they were before?
I think it was in the early 40s, actually. Yeah, it was the 50s if you bought stock before 1929. If you bought stock in 32, you made your money back by the early 40s. But yeah, you're right.
So you have 4 million people, according to Nancy Pelosi, on unemployment. She says it's the highest level of unemployment in 26 years. It's actually according to the Labor Department. She believes that there needs to be a second stimulus and they are working very intensely on that.
Here's the thing, Ellen, I don't understand. Our Democratic politicians think that the way that you're going to jumpstart the middle class, the way we're going to bring back, the way that we're going to revive the middle class, the way we're going to breathe some life into this, you know, been hit by a bus body, is by throwing some money at them. And the reality is that a middle class is built on strong wages. Well, instead of talking about, you know, hey, let's send them another $300 check. That'll be good for 6 months. Why don't they talk about raising the minimum wage? Why don't they talk about protectionist legislation that would require American content and things manufactured in the United States, or that would reimpose tariffs on imported goods? Why don't they talk about the things that will bring back the good jobs in the United States? Why don't they talk about unionization? You know, the old Honeymooners show with Ralph Cramden and Jackie Gleason. You know, or Jackie Gleason playing Ralph Cramden, his buddy, I'm forgetting his name right now. You know, he worked in the sewers and he had a good job and he had a pension and he had, you know, he was a union member. I mean, there was honor in labor back in the day. What's happened?
I don't have the answer to that. I can tell you, for instance, I had dinner with some Cleveland people last night. We're talking all about Parma, Ohio. Big boom in the 50s, still has a GM plant, still has a Ford plant on either side of the Parma Mall. And things, I mean, if those places close, you have an entire area of Ohio. This isn't just Michigan. We're talking about major places around the country.
Right. Not to mention car dealers all over the country. I mean, it's and car parts and car manufacturing. We will have a Great Depression if these two automakers shut down in the next 3 months.
And what is interesting is Christopher Dodd said today that the big three have done more than the financial industry to show they deserve financial support.
Yep.
And the rescue package at this point is $34 billion. He said, and people, you know, there are not apparently enough votes to go with this. And you can only say, why have we rescued? And then some people are saying whether they should take this from the $700 billion that they've already done to deal with these companies. But no one knows.
Yeah, no, they gave over $30 billion to Robert Rubin's company, Citibank, that he helped run into the ground.
Rubin's
with the
not
same...
in such great shape right now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a marvelous op-ed about Robert Rubin in today's Financial Times, in fact. The headline is, "Time to Give Something Back, Bob," by John Gapper. And, you know, how Robert Rubin is, you know, he's our putz of the year, I'm telling you. But you know, he didn't have to come and say he didn't fly in on his corporate jet and plead for his 30-some-odd billion dollars for Citicorp. You know, I mean, why is it that the guys who represent the blue-collar jobs have to jump through all the hoops and have to drive all the way to Washington, D.C., and the guys who represent the bankers, they just show up and say, hey, how about some money? Oh, yeah, sure, no problem. $100 billion, $200 billion, $300 billion, guarantee you to $2 trillion, no problem. I mean, this is nuts.
I have no idea, but I've got to tell you that the problem is that we have a situation where it is the automakers are getting screwed in this, and the other people, such as the financial situation, are getting bailed out. And the workers and people who have worked their entire lives on the assembly line and auto workers are giving this up. They don't make this kind of money.
Yeah.
And
people are starting at GM now at $15 an hour.
And right. And one other thing that's kind of, I mean, I've got a couple other things, but one of the things is now they're trying to take a look, and this is actually Lloyd Doggett of Texas is now taking a look at the stuff. And he is saying, we're not going to give these tax breaks to banks that are overtaking other banks. That's what they're looking for.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, actually, that's a good thing, not giving tax breaks to, and that's $140 welfare program for the banks. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen, for the news report.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Coming up tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie, Senator Bernie Sanders. Every Friday, comes on our show and takes your calls, your chance to ask, confront, harass, be friendly with, whatever you'd like, compliment, United States Senator. Bernie will take the calls. Plus, Lamar Walter, my friend and co-author on Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy, is going to be here about our new book. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.